Welcome to Local Talk, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Kelly Diekman is here with me, Ames Planning and Housing Director, and we're going to talk about a major project, envisioning the future for a major part of Ames, Lincoln Way. Welcome, Kelly. Thank you for coming in. Let's talk about the Lincoln Corridor Project. This is described as a detailed plan for the Lincoln Way Corridor, which is primary roadway between the east and the west part of town. Used to be one of the only roadways going through town. And it stretches about 7 miles, a little less than 7 miles through town. And according to the public information about the Lincoln Corridor, it's a plan for land use, development, traffic, mobility, urban design, infrastructure, and for investments in the area. The relationship or balance between development and community use for the area along the road. Is that a good way to describe what the project is looking at?
The plan kind of takes every concept that we have and applies it in a focused manner just within a block of Lincoln Way. Why you would do a corridor plan is because you want to focus in on something that's unique. And we all know Lincoln Way is unique as the main arterial that's east-west with a lot of different uses that are on it. So we tried to tackle each of those. Each issue applies differently throughout the corridor. So we've broken it down. It's not just 1 7-mile plan. It has focus areas in it.
Different sections.
Yeah, different areas have different issues. So we had to break that down into what we called focus areas, and we had 5 of those. And then some of the issues do cross-cut. That's another reason why we did the corridor plan, is improving or enhancing mobility for pedestrians or bicyclists is one of those themes. That doesn't come out of the corridor plan, but we're taking that from our long-range transportation plan and trying to keep that center in the plan along with the land use issues that also affect transportation.
There's a separate plan for transportation going on, and you're kind of integrating the two.
Yeah, so the city does have a long-range transportation plan that was adopted about a year and a half ago. So a lot of the concepts about improved mobility and enhancing bicycle facilities and pedestrian ways, that's in there, but it's not necessarily translated to the level that a land use plan would have. Mm-hmm. So we want to keep those ideas of what big types of transportation improvements are going to happen or plan to happen, and then work with that from the land use side of it as well. Ames has traditionally kind of looked at things as single topic issues. Mm-hmm. In a corridor plan, you can't do that or you won't accomplish very much, because you'll just focus then on striping on a street, or you'll focus on what the building looks like. So here you want to say, acknowledge what the transportation facilities are or what you're looking for them to become, because usually you want to match the building or the land use to that. You don't want to turn your back on a transit corridor. So you have to be responsive to the transportation in a corridor plan.
Needless to say, this is a very dynamic situation with a lot going on.
It is, especially because it's so diverse across the corridor with different priorities. All right, so you're trying to take a segment of the city and try and move the planning ahead a little faster than we are for the rest of the city, thinking it's a more dynamic area and has more issues that are really specific just to Lincoln Way that aren't necessarily community issues.
Before I get into asking you about the actual areas and some of the details so that we can get a sense of what this really is, what is the basic idea of doing this?
I think it helps to kind of understand why we even started this.
Okay.
So the city has a comprehensive plan that we call the Land Use Policy Plan, and it has different chapters about land use and transportation and some other things. We adopted that in 1997. So when I started, I've been here for about 3 years. We know we're kind of at the end of the lifespan of that plan. And it seemed that we had a lot of issues around Lincoln Way, and that 1997 plan really didn't think of Lincoln Way the way it is today. How could it? Things have changed so much since then. So we weren't quite ready to look at a full-blown review of the city in a comprehensive plan, but we kept having issues come back to a lot of things along Lincoln Way. So it made a lot of sense.
Can you give me an example of
what are redevelopment options near downtown? How does Kellogg maybe work as a gateway to downtown? What are really the housing needs that we have along the corridor? What are the condition of housing in that area? Cyride was not Cyride in 1997. The amount of buses that we have and how the system works didn't exist in 1997. And West Ames, the bus levels, the ridership in that area is tremendous. So it's not something you could have even known in 97.
Right.
So we looked at that. We said, hey, a good idea here would be just do a corridor plan, and we'll come back and deal with the rest of the city. But we can definitely look at the corridor plan in the next year and a half, which is where we are now. So at this point, we've gotten to what I call the final draft. We presented that to the city council in April. And at this point, we're back cleaning up that document, making some edits to it, and then we'll bring it back for council adoption here probably in June to have the council kind of prioritize what the goals are. It's a very broad plan, has a lot of things in it. can't possibly all do them in the first year that are in there. So council, the big choices are going to be, council, how do you want to prioritize implementation for the plan?
There was a call for input.
We held three different public forums at the outset. Mm-hmm. We set up a website. You could use a mapping tool to just point things out that you thought were concerns or good things on the corridor. And then we also had a survey that we broke down into businesses, into residents, and then into students, kind of thinking there's three different kind of user groups. And anybody in the community could participate online or come to a meeting. We got some really good input last year to kind of set out what people were seeing and thinking of priorities. And then from there, we went into doing some workshops last summer to have people kind of say their preferences, give some more detailed comments to us. And then we spent a lot of time going back and actually putting the plan together. And we came up with some alternatives that we again presented in sort of a workshop format in the winter to get mm-hmm. then to that draft plan. So we've tried to keep in contact. I think we have over 100 people that are frequent followers of the plan.
I heard a conversation you had with a child who was maybe about 10, and he had concerns about tree houses. And I have to say I was very impressed at how you engaged with him and took him very seriously.
He was there with his father. He was hearing from his dad what his dad's concerns were and changing that into what mattered to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was living in one of these residential areas. And one of the early drafts of the plan had shown how if we had constructed a new alley, how things could change in that neighborhood. Well, that alley would have affected their property significantly. And that's where they were coming from, is how can you show something like this that really doesn't fit and mm-hmm. would really affect us.
And he was afraid it would destroy his treehouse.
And he had turned that into, well, I have a tree back here. I'm going to build a treehouse this summer. Mm-hmm. And we don't have that piece of the alley in there any longer. That was a result of that input of that neighborhood. So that's out of the plan now.
The treehouse stays.
Treehouse can get built, yes.
So, okay, tell us what the different sections are.
So the plan does have an overall framework to guide everything about the corridor. But then we did break it into what we have five focus areas where we looked at really truly land use alternatives to see what really people were okay with in looking at change.
So this really is about changing things.
Yes.
And in some ways quite dramatically.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And five of those areas, and they're all different. Focus area one was the area near downtown between Duff and Clark, essentially. And both sides of the street, so north and south sides of the street. So this is the area where you have Burger King, you have Starbucks, you have some of the pawn shops, you have some of the tire shops, you have a lot of stuff there.
And this is an area where the change would be quite dramatic.
This is where we're looking at, so we're very supportive of tremendous change.
Mm-hmm.
So you have your just very typical 1960s strip commercial, a lot of driveway cuts, not real good sidewalks, no trees, parking's kind of in front of buildings, on the side of buildings, all over the place. It's just kind of your traditional corridor mess that you had from highways that changed. In you had areas that weren't car driven when they were laid out and became car driven in the 60s. That's a common corridor issue. So for this, Ames has always, or at least for the last 10 years, thought of Kellogg as should be the gateway or a front door to downtown, since downtown is on the north sides of the railroad tracks and doesn't actually touch Lincoln Way. And we took it to say, well, we're not trying to just be a gateway to downtown. We see this as a complementary environment.
So you're really talking about the area between Lincoln Way and Main Street and the railroad tracks.
Just to the tracks, not all the way to
Main Street.
To the
tracks.
Yep. So we went in this plan to say, hey, this is the most intense area of the city. If we're going to do infill development and do it the right way, this is probably the best place to do it. When I say the right way, take advantage of density.
What is infill development?
Infill is not growing outside of your current footprint. So not going into the green fields, expanding into corn and other fields and areas. So infill is when you're taking the footprints you already have within the city and then intensifying them and redeveloping them. So campus town is basically infill redevelopment. So you're not building new five-story buildings on the edge of town. You're putting them in the center where you have resources already there to serve them. So that came out pretty clearly that people were willing to see that happen there, not as a competition but as complementary. Because the things in downtown, we can't replicate Main Street. We don't want to replicate Main Street.
So in a way, it kind of extends downtown.
In a way, it's going to signify you're in an urban area here, not just a pass-through area. And you're going to probably take notice of Kellogg as an entryway, see downtown, but also see new development and think this is where there is energy and activity in the city.
So, for instance, say in 15 years, what could potentially be in that area between Lincoln Way and the railroad track?
Well, I think a boutique hotel would be helpful to be next to downtown. It would.
And what exactly is a boutique hotel?
A smaller operator of maybe like a 50-room or 40-room hotel can be a little quirky. Really.
Possibly a local business.
It could be, yeah. Mm-hmm. It could be a smaller, medium-level kind of operator rather than like a Hilton Garden Inn. And, mm-hmm. and again, we would be happy with a Hilton Garden Inn because we have no hotel in that area. And it would be good to have that in that. A lot of people that travel want to be near services, want to be in walkable environments. If you're visiting the city, you have to stay on the edge of the city to go do business in the city. It's you just don't have a choice. So I think it's pretty clear a hotel would probably survive and do well mm-hmm. in an area where it's more walkable. If we think there's a chance to do bigger venues of entertainment or restaurant uses, kind of create a center of energy, pull people into one area of the city for activity, and we can do that by putting these larger uses next to downtown.
What is a larger use?
Like a larger restaurant or entertainment venue of maybe it's a small musical venue, maybe it was a film or a theater venue. We're not talking.
So you're talking about building hotels, restaurants, and theaters.
Those are choices that kind of all go towards that goal of adding activity and energy there. There would definitely be housing with it. There would definitely be some replacement retail. And we would also like to see some office use come back in there. That's another one of those issues where some people do want to work. Again, we don't have a lot of choices in our walkable environments. So we want to bring as many choices back into these walkable areas. And the corridor plan is going to make it more walkable. You wouldn't go out on Lincoln Way right now and feel it's a great walkable pedestrian environment. But mm-hmm. when these buildings redevelop, we'll get right-of-way space back. We can add in landscaping. We can add in sidewalks or appropriate widths. We can deal with bicycle facilities in the long term being adequate for people to not just have to worry about how the car traffic is. Probably going to be a mixed-use environment with residential, commercial, and then some of these other uses sprinkled in over time as well.
What I hear is that area between Lincoln Way and the railroad tracks, mm-hmm. you're saying that that would be potentially an area that would be with dense buildings, some of them taller buildings.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
and then you would have businesses in there like restaurants and theaters, hotels, apartments. You have to attract people who want to build these things, right?
Yes. It's redevelopment. So a lot of people are scared by redevelopment because it's more complicated, it's more expensive, and it takes longer.
Mm-hmm.
And in the real estate world, more expensive takes longer and less predictable are the opposite of how they work. So you got to have mm-hmm. some time and some patience to get people aligned with where you want to go as a city.
And also the people that own the properties there now, are they prepared to sell that?
They have to be willing sellers. Some people mm-hmm. have aggregated a few properties together and could probably do something on their own. But then you're right. We as the city aren't coming in and taking property and trying to purchase it and land bank it. That's not how mm-hmm. this is set up. It's meant to drive market-based decisions by private property owners to say, hey, you have some more value here. If you sell, it would be more valuable.
So in other words, a plan like this is ultimately suggestions. It's not something the city can actually dictate.
It's policy that the city will follow, but we don't force private property owners to mm-hmm. They can't do things that are against the plan, but we can't make them fulfill the ultimate goals of the plan because mm-hmm. we don't have interest in their property.
Okay, so the area down here by the railroad tracks, that's the vision for that is to turn it into a more urban area,
yep.
A denser, more highly used area that feels a little bit more like the Main Street area in terms of how it's being used.
It might be. In terms of comparing to something today, it might be more of the scale of campus town with mm-hmm. how you've seen the 5 and 6 story buildings come in. I don't want to say it will look like campus town, but in terms of size, those are probably some of the building types that you would see come in
okay.
that area.
So now if you go a little bit west of here,
mm-hmm.
you're in the area, which is a residential area between campus town.
Yeah,
downtown. So, that's a different section. What's the primary issue there?
And we actually had two focus areas there.
Mm-hmm.
So between Squaw Creek and Grand Avenue, we have the Oak Riverside neighborhood, which is one of our core vital neighborhoods. And then you kind of have another kind of just empty land of DOT area. You have the DOT offices, and then to the north, they have some satellite facilities, and you have a bunch of older buildings that are kind of just not frequented by anybody. So we had two different areas there. Oak Riverside was really brought about by, this is a residential area with an arterial street through it, right through the middle. This isn't two neighborhoods, one to the north, one to the south. It's really one neighborhood. So it's unique. Ames neighborhoods on Lincoln Way are kind of north and south, not divided by the road. And then you had the housing issue there. How do we support this neighborhood? They have a lot of single family homes. They're looking for more family ownership and have concerns about rental concentration. Mm-hmm. That proximity to campus brings a lot of rental demand into there. And they've been working on that issue for over 20 years. So how does the corridor plan deal with that? It's a question of, could we add new building types that might improve the look along the street, maybe allow for reinvestment in maybe having an ownership and maybe a rental unit with it. It was very clear from the beginning, again, wholesale redevelopment here, not a choice. This is a neighborhood with integrity that we want to maintain. So are there any small implementation things that we could do? So that one really ended up getting down to a very small level of saying there's really three blocks that front Lincoln Way where we could consider looking at a way to add to maybe add a rental unit behind or with an existing house rather than say we're going to build apartment buildings or we're going to build townhouses all along the street. So that one was, from a land use side, it was really the land use isn't changing. We're trying to suggest there's better buildings that could be built. But the big conversation element in that area was to think about the transportation itself, right, which is to come back to the bicycle and sidewalk facilities through the area.
Right. If I remember correctly, the gentleman with the child with him, one of his big concerns was the fact that you wanted to reduce the number of lanes on Lincoln Way.
Yeah. So the long-range transportation plan first broached the idea that in Ames, and this is kind of a national trend, when you build four-lane roads, they're really good for high-capacity straight travel. But if you don't really have that level of vehicle traffic, it's kind of a waste of space.
Is this the road diet
this
concept?
This gets to the road diet. So if you
so
have
a road
waste,
diet is?
Is to narrow down the amount of travel lanes for vehicles and then reclaim that space for something else. Mm-hmm. And it could be to do on-street bike lanes. It could be to add landscape, streetscape planners. It could be to add a median or boulevard to a roadway. So once you've said, I don't need four lanes of traffic, I can live with three, you've freed up at least 12 feet of space. And any engineer or planner would love to get 12 feet of space. We can do something with that.
Mm-hmm.
So in this neighborhood, long-range transportation plan says we need better bike facilities east-west through the city. So we took that concept and said, hey, this is a residential area. Up to, not through Grand, but close to Grand, there's a volume of traffic here that the traffic engineers say you can support it with just three lanes instead of four. It will work. And then you would have an ability to widen your sidewalks, maybe put bike lanes in and do things that would facilitate other kinds of travel behavior in the area.
Yeah, another operative word here is connectivity with bicycles.
Yes.
That bicyclists want connectivity so they can get from one end of town to the other.
Yeah, so that was a big part of the long-range transportation plan was to say you might have some facilities, but they're very disconnected in Ames.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those core issues was you just can't go east-west through the city in a connected manner. We'll develop out, and we have already this shared use path concept all along Lincoln Way on the south side. It'll get better. It's not the greatest bicycle facility, but it will at least have that. But then you get to Oak Riverside, and you get to an area where you're 2 feet from a four-lane road, and you're on a four-foot sidewalk.
Right.
You don't have the space to make a comfortable environment. So that's one of the reasons why we were looking at that. So that's controversial to people because it's hard to imagine where are those cars going to go.
So what is the answer to his question about what happens when there's a football game?
Well, we generally don't manage for the most extreme events in a city. Transportation engineers do not manage for the single worst traffic level in a city. I think we've learned our lessons in the planning world and in the traffic engineering world. If you do that, that's to a detriment to the rest of your community for the rest of the year because you overbuild capacity that's not necessary. It's costly. It takes up space. It's not necessary. I'm not ever going to say that on game day, traffic will run smoothly if you do something differently. We were looking at how's your everyday traffic work.
And your assessment is every day, three lanes on Lincoln Way is enough?
It's satisfactory to meet your basic expectations for level of service. There would be some diversion. People would pick different routes. Fourth Street would get more traffic. maybe 6th Street would pick up a few more vehicles as well. So we modeled that to see what would happen. We didn't just go in and say we're going to draw some lines. So we did do a traffic model. Mm-hmm. And that's where the traffic engineers did say it can work. It'll be a choice of the city. It's on that threshold of where it could work.
Mm-hmm.
And
so this is in some ways a choice that the city's making for its future in terms of what kind of a city it is. And in a way, what I'm hearing with this concept of the road diet and the connectivity with the bicycles, that the choice is being made to make the city of Ames more accessible for people to walk, for more accessible people to ride bikes, for public transportation. It's somewhat of a shift of focus.
I think it's to try and balance out. Yeah, it's to balance out the emphasis that's been on a vehicle for 40 or 50 years, to bring back what other people want to do with how they get places. And that's a common theme across the city right now. And this was that big information or big input we got in that long range transportation plan. And this comes back to, again, our comp plan, our comprehensive plan. It had some notions about, yeah, we want vital neighborhoods and we want to support transportation of all choices. But you move that ahead to 2017 from 1997. It's just a different way of thinking about it. You're more precise in what you expect and then how you program for that or budget for those changes.
This is information you got from residents?
Yes. So the long-range transportation mm-hmm. plan had a very similar outreach process to what I described for the corridor, a number of outreach workshops in different areas of the city, businesses, students, residents, different advocacy groups like Ames Bicycle Coalition and other people that had maybe special interests mm-hmm. around transportation.
So things have shifted a little bit in terms of how people want to live in the city.
Yeah. So in my 3 years that I've been here, I think the conversation about multimodal transportation, meaning bike, ped, and vehicle, has been at the forefront of many council conversations. Mm-hmm. I'd say it was probably more in the background previously, and then in the last 2 years, because of the long-range transportation process, mm-hmm. it's really come out to be in the forefront of things that we need to plan for because we weren't really doing that yet mm-hmm. at the level that people were asking for now. Mm-hmm. So we satisfied people for many years, but then it's clear the expectations are higher now mm-hmm. to do more.
Is this interesting, exciting for you to make this kind of planning?
Yeah, I think this is what planners are always trying to look at, is to take mm-hmm. what do people want to get to, and then how do we strategize around that to mm-hmm. to get there. And there's not a lot of quick payoff for planning. This is over time. Even if we decided we wanted to do the road diet in Oak Riverside, that's not happening next year.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get it into, you know, it's a functional roadway now. You got to get into the maintenance and replacement costs and how and when you design to make those changes. So a lot mm-hmm. of things don't happen right away. But, mm-hmm. yeah, planners are trying to always set up the framework to get us to where we want to be.
Yeah.
And like I said, next year when we start the comp plan, it's going to be the same kind of effort but on a much different scale.
Okay. Well, we're running out of time, but we haven't gone west of town at all.
Give us
just a sense of what the issues are in west.
So one other thing that was one of the main building blocks of the plan was that campus town at this point is not expected to continue. We use the phrase march west. So at Highland, there's a new building under construction at the corner of Highland and Lincoln Way. That's viewed as this hard break, a line where we're not going to keep marching five-story buildings down Lincoln Way. So that area, which now is a bunch of small houses, kind of like Oak Riverside, but really not because they're smaller, older houses, that's a housing stock that needs some help. So rather than say we're going to look for consolidation and do five-story apartment buildings, we looked at looking for ways to allow for townhomes to be built, or other small homes to kind of replace what's there, knowing it's probably a student rental kind of environment, but it could be supportive of the corridor at the same time. And we can get rid of driveways, again, get better sidewalks, get bicycle facilities. So that plan there is a little bit different than Oak Riverside, but it was pretty clear that it's not going to be campus town. And then you get to West Hy-Vee area, and that's kind of one of the few kind of shopping center kind of environments that we have in Ames. We just don't really have a lot of shopping centers. And so that one, mostly the commercial is going to stay there. But some of the fringe areas we did identify where maybe a few more higher density apartments could be added. Again, recognizing you have great transit access, you have great daily services with a grocery store, medical services. It's one of those nodes. We would use the word node. on a corridor to say where there's concentrated services, that's a node where mm-hmm. you want to intensify and activate space. So mm-hmm. West Hy-Vee area, it's a shopping center, but it is a node for us on the corridor, and there's some fringe improvements that we could see for intensity of land use.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, that was the fifth area. What you saw as you went further west is there is lacking bicycle facilities. There's lack of sidewalks. Again, those mm-hmm. single-family areas that were built in the last 15 years aren't really connected into the city. So the, mm-hmm. so the framework plan overall says, yeah, these are the transportation links that need to be done as you continue to build west.
Mm-hmm. And so the things like sidewalks and the changes to the roads, that's something the city can do on its own.
With one exception, the Lincoln Way from Grand to Duff Avenue is actually a state highway. So we so in that Kellogg area that we were talking about, we have the road diet in there as well. Mm-hmm. However, as a highway, that can't happen. So you have to have a long-term thought that maybe someday we could do a jurisdictional transfer with DOT. And if we got control of the road, then we can control the format. We know DOT is never going to go to a three-lane road. That's just not how transportation departments work there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that would be really long term to get to road diet out there. But mm-hmm. everywhere else, it's in city control. We need to coordinate with SciRide. Mm-hmm. They're a huge customer of ours in terms of how they use the right of way. So we can't forget about them when we're planning for other modes and transportation choices out there. So you're always trying to balance all four needs, bicycle, mm-hmm. At least on Lincoln Way, transit, vehicle, bicyclist and pedestrian. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. It's not perfect for everybody, but you're always trying to get the best balance at the highest return.
So this plan now has been brought to the city council. It's been being tweaked right now, according to maybe some responses they had, and there's a final version being made. And then after that, basically then it's up to the city council to begin implementation. And so I'm kind of rolling off the how this looks in my mind.
So implementations means a lot of things. So we'll bring the plan back, and let's say they like all the concepts for the focus areas about what types of buildings, what kinds of transportation facilities they want to say are our policy. As we mentioned before, you don't just go rebuild a road in 1 year. There's a lot of cost in that, and you plan for that. So implementation is a combination of what further studies or design work need to be done to really flesh out some more details that might not be there yet. What everyday zoning changes, the things in the plan, you can't build today. So we need to change the rules to even allow for that to happen. Mm-hmm. And then the third one is what we call the Capital Improvements Program, the CIP. And that's where the city budgets out the money to do public facility improvements, whether mm-hmm. it's to redo a roadway, to do a different traffic signal, to pave something, to widen sidewalks. So those three things together are what council will have to say, what's our priority.
And the rule changing is how they encourage private businesses and landowners to make decisions.
Yeah.
So it's a way of kind of influencing their decision-making.
Yeah.
And will this vision be rolled out somewhere for people to look at? Can we see it on the web?
It'll be we have a project website. If you were to do a search for Ames Lincoln Corridor Plan, you'll either get to the planning webpage with a link to the project's website, or you'll find the project's website immediately, and mm-hmm. you can look at it there.
Okay.
Yeah, I think on the implementation side, it's pretty clear the first thing we will do for sure is to tackle that zoning issue for Kellogg, just because what we've talked about there just is not permissible, mm-hmm. and we want it to at least be permissible. So I think this summer you'll see a lot of activity on how to allow for that redevelopment there, and then we'll look at what other issues need dealt with after that.
So potentially 20 years down the road, this area near downtown could look dramatically different.
Yeah, I think we'd hope to see one or two types of projects maybe in the next 5 years, but you don't see a whole three blocks change in 5 years.
Right.
So we're hoping for a few projects to set the tone in the next couple of years and then see that evolve again over time over the next 10 years.
Okay.
And I think the way we see this now from timing perspective, the corridor plan, assuming it's adopted and accepted by council, will be one of those building blocks that we use for the comprehensive plan update. We're not going to go back and revisit the policy assumptions of the corridor plan. Instead, we'll build from that. We'll mm-hmm. use that notion of our policy of infill for the corridor and build from that on how we look at the rest of the city as well.
I'm speaking with Kelly Diekman, Planning and Housing Director. I'm Ursula Rudenberg on Local Talk. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
You're welcome.
Really appreciate it.
hummingbird whispers round the door. Hummingbird whispers round the door. In my heart, a dream of love and more. In my heart, a dream of love and more. Tiny crimson diver, flying feathered fire. In my heart, a dream of love and more. Black crow casting shadows on the corn. Black crow casting shadows on the corn. In my heart, a prayer for peace is born. In my heart, a prayer for peace is born. Winged night returning to feel the knife-edged yearning. In my heart, a prayer for peace is born. Bright filigree of singing birds at dawn. Of singing birds at dawn. In my heart, the wild red rose and thorn. In my heart, the wild red rose and thorn.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg, and that was Susan Osborne, former resident of Ames, singing Hummingbird. Let's go now to Patch Larbaum with a spring report on the peregrine falcon. It's May, and the babies are hatching.
This is Patch Larbaum with a phenology for today about peregrine falcons. Phenology is the recording of important events in nature when they are happening, and peregrine falcons will be hatching young soon. Whether referred to as the great-footed hawk, a long wing, a duck hawk, a rock hawk, or a blue meanie, the peregrine falcon occupies a unique position in our psyche of bird lore. Since medieval times, falconers have accompanied peregrines on hunting forays. The species was extirpated or lost as a breeding bird from the eastern United States by 1965. It is widely believed the last nesting pair was at Capilli Bluff, downstream from Lansing, Iowa. Early 20th century newspaper accounts tell of town folks walking down the railroad tracks by the river for spring equinox to celebrate the return of their falcons to the cliffs. In 1962, scientist and author of Silent Spring, Rachel Carson, sounded an alarm foretelling bird extinctions from ravaging biocides of the post-World War II era, particularly DDT. Although the chemical industry demeaned and criticized Carson's research, a basic law of nature was becoming obvious. Whatever affects wildlife ultimately affects humans. Realization of a silent spring was resonating, and legislation was needed to ban DDT and related culprits. The Endangered Species Act was implemented in 1972, and DDT was banned in the United States. However, it was too late for peregrines that no longer nested east of the Missouri River. These top-of-the-food-chain raptors were wiped out in the wild. Beginning in 1989, the peregrine presence has improved in Iowa. Predictably, there will be a lot of falcons flying over this stretch of the Mississippi River in early summer. Bob Anderson with the Raptor Resource Project and Lowell Washburn, who was the chair of the Iowa Falconry Recovery Team, complimented each other in releasing wild birds that started this successful reintroduction. Iowa's first nesting pairs in 1993 occurred at Des Moines and Cedar Rapids. The Cedar Rapids pair on their U.S. Bank building will begin hatching soon. And in Des Moines, pairs will be hatching young on the east side of the state capitol and downtown at the American Enterprise Building, where they have been since 1993. There is a 2014 female falcon from downtown Des Moines at a cliff site at Wyalusing State Park in Wisconsin, just across the river from Pikes Peak State Park here in Iowa. This is the first instance of a building falcon crossing over to a natural cliff. The male is a solid cliff nesting bird that attracted the city bird to his eyrie or nest site. Elsewhere, falcons are hatching at the Mid-American Energy headquarters in Davenport, and there is a webcam that you can enjoy watching these birds by Googling WQAD falcons, F-A-L-C-O-N-S. Young falcons hone their flight skills engaging in mock combat flights that provide incredible visual high-speed chases and maneuvers. So let me try to describe a stoop or a dive of a peregrine falcon. As a speck in the sky at 2,000 feet, a peregrine falcon rolls over, folding its long wings. The falcon's descent exceeds 270 miles per hour during the dive or stoop. The speck becomes a bionic missile with anatomical attributes to do what it does and how it does it very well. See-through nictitating membranes arise from the lower eyelids to protect its eyes from dust or wind-blown seeds. Baffles in its nasal cavities ensure the back of the skull is not blown out from its velocity. When diving at prey straight ahead, from great distance at great speed, a peregrine has a conflict between vision and aerodynamics. With eyes on each side of its head, it must turn its head approximately 40 degrees to see the prey. Doing this, maximum visual acuity at the deep fovea of one eye is achieved. However, the head in this position increases aerodynamic drag and slows the falcon down. The falcon could resolve this conflict by holding its head straight and flying along a logarithmic spiral path that keeps the line of sight of the deep fovea pointed sideways at the prey. And a wild peregrine observed with spotting scope and tracking device indeed approached prey the size of a pigeon from distances of up to 4,500 feet by holding its head straight and descending along a curved path that resembles the logarithmic spiral. As the diving falcon approaches its prey, its talons are clenched into a knuckle. The prey is dispatched into a poof of feathers with a knuckle to its noggin. In the case of larger birds like a duck, the prey is stunned, then grabbed and ridden to the shore. The falcon's beak is specifically notched to separate the vertebrae of its quarry in a most efficient manner. The ensuing feeding frenzy is unlike any spectacle of spearing flesh, tendons, and muscle with feathers flying in a spray of mortal being than anyone could ever imagine. It certainly sustains the peregrine's vitality until the next spectacle unfolds. And that's our phenology on peregrine falcons for today.
And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for today, and with the coming of spring, it's a good time for Mary Rankin, Director of Sustainability for Iowa State University and Sustainability Coordinator for the City of Ames, to join us to talk about our wonderful city parks. Welcome back, Mary, and you brought a guest with you.
I
did. To talk about sustaining our beautiful parks in Ames.
Most definitely. Well, you know, I think, as you mentioned, with things getting warmer and greener, we immediately think about being outside, enjoying the wonderful outside, and we have such a wonderful bounty of outside recreation, green areas around our lovely community. And if you think about sustainability, I mean, one of the things that we take, I think, very for granted is that the parks are there. But from a sustainability standpoint, I don't think that we realize all the thought and care that our city folks go or take into consideration in maintaining these areas to ensure that they are safe for us as we are recreating, as well as just continually enjoyable and accessible. And so with that in mind, I'm very honored to have with me today Joshua Thompson, who's Parks and Facilities Superintendent with the City of Ames Parks and Recreation Department, to talk more about these really cool things happening in our parks.
Welcome. Thank you for coming.
Well, thank you to you both for having me here. This is great.
Our pleasure.
Yeah.
So you, what do you actually do?
So my official title is the Parks and Facilities Superintendent in the Parks and Recreation Department. Don't know if many people know this. I know that a lot of people think that we have a lot of parks, but some people don't know specifically how many we have. We oversee 36 parks.
I was going to say, you notice I didn't mention
the
exact
right.
number.
We oversee, it's
36
interesting when,
parks.
It's interesting when you ask people that question. We oversee 36 parks, oversee over 1,200 acres.
That's amazing in our little community,
yeah.
right?
Wow. So it's a really, it's a great opportunity for us and our staff to be able to take care of the land like this.
So how many people do this?
So we have currently we have two maintenance supervisors. One oversees the structural part of it, the playgrounds part of it, the shelters, basically the structures. And then we have an individual as a turf maintenance supervisor, and they both have staff under them, a total of 8 maintenance workers and 2 maintenance specialists. And we are going to hire a forester here shortly, hopefully in the next few months, to take care of our woodlands.
Mm-hmm. It's actually a relatively small staff for 36 parks.
Yeah.
I would say so. Yeah.
Small but mighty. You know,
small but mighty.
We do an excellent job.
So. Okay, so let's get into it. Let's talk about some of the specific ways that you do actually keep the parks and support them.
Yeah, so specifically, you know, in regards to the 1,200 acres, I would say, and I don't have a specific number, but we mow close to 300 acres probably every 7 to 10 days. And so that's a lot of turf area to cover. And we have 3 main mowers, mowing equipment that use to take care of that turf. And part of that is the mowers that we use, we're not using small 60-inch mowers that you'd find in a residential neighborhood. We're using big mowers so we can cover a lot of ground quickly. Mm-hmm. Some people think, well, that's a big piece of equipment. Well, we only have 3 of them, so we cover a lot of ground really quickly, and that's our goal, is to get our turf mowed every 7 to 10 days. But also, we keep our mowing heights between 3 to 3.5 inches. We feel and we believe that if you have thick turf, it crowds out weeds. And one of the things that people don't understand, and we're not, our goal is not to be weed free in our turfs and our park system. That's obviously, that's not our goal, but we want to make sure that we are doing our part to make sure that we are good neighbors, but also providing healthy turf. Healthy turf is an excellent, excellent water filter. It limits stormwater going down the storm drain. And it's a, like I said, it's an excellent filter of water. And so if we have healthy weed-free turf, we're on our way to improving the ecosystem that way.
Most definitely. And I think one thing that we don't think about is we'll still have some water that can go into the storm sewer system, but it's slowing it down, mm-hmm. and it's cleaning it before it gets there.
Right. As long as we can treat it over land, it's a lot easier and a lot better for the system, for the environment. If we can have the water go over land, be treated that way instead of being directed through a pipe,
mm-hmm.
and going directly into the creeks and rivers.
And you're talking about turf, but you also bring some prairie into the parks, right?
Yeah. You know, a couple of exciting projects we have going on, especially at Ada Hayden, where there's 50 acres on the north side of the park that are going to be transferred or going to be renovated into prairie.
Yeah, I noticed a lot of it's burned
fantastic.
Down right now.
Yeah, so
we go out there right now.
Yeah,
it's
we did some burning, and then we had an individual that sprayed the species there last fall, and then we're going to do the seeding in June, and it's a pretty. If anybody's ever seeded prairie before, it's a very extensive project, but mm-hmm. it's going to be very, very neat. We've worked through – there's a program that the University of Northern Iowa has set aside to do specific seeding rates and species for that. So we worked with them. We're also working with Story County Conservation to get that taken care of. So it's going to be a really neat project, and when it's all finished.
That's just fantastic. There's there's nothing better for me than large open areas of prairie, such diversity, and wow, supporting so many species within that area.
Is Ada Hayden the only park in Ames that has prairie?
No, we also have prairie in East River Valley Park, which is across the creek from the old carpool site or a car park. There's another area, Christopherson Park, which is off of Oakwood Road. There's about 2 acres of prairie down there. And then also we have prairie species in some of our, if you look around town, we've incorporated bioswales, in some of the street islands. If you go to the Furman Aquatic Center parking lot, those things are bioswales that are filled with native plants. So we can treat the water coming off the parking lot. So there's may not huge areas of prairie in the parks. But also just if people look around, there's, we're trying to add those areas, in our, you know.
What is a bioswale?
So basically, it's a it's a small water treatment area that water can be filtered running off a parking lot or a hard surface to filter it and clean it before it goes into into the ecosystem or into the environment. So and basically those are filled with sometimes and you can help me out with this, Mary, but a lot of them are filled with native plants, but there's also some mulches and some other filtering products that are put in those so the water can be easily cleaned and filtered that way instead of like I said, going directly into a storm sewer pipe.
In some areas they're almost you wouldn't even know they're necessarily there because of the mulch. So a lot of the wetland capability is almost submerged from the surface from where you would see it, but still does such an impressive job of filtering that water, treating it where it is, utilizing it where it is, and just not having all those other pieces that you have to deal with downstream.
Exactly.
I think another thing that many of us wonder is in the management of fertilizer and weed control, how much toxin is used? What kind of products are the city using?
So that's a good question. In regards to fertilizer, one of the big topics in this, especially the state of Iowa right now, is phosphorus in the water system. You know, you hear it, you know, the Des Moines Water Works, they were dealing with it as far as the amount of nutrients nutrients that were getting into their water system. But in the city of Ames, like I said earlier, we believe that if you have healthy, strong turf, we'll crowd out the weeds. So we do use fertilizer. We use it on our golf course, but we use an IPM program. It's called Integrated Pest Management. So we're looking at every aspect to make that healthy turf. It's not just dumping a bunch of fertilizer or chemicals on it. It's using, okay, what other cultural practice can we do to make sure that we have healthy turf? We aerate. You know, we mow at the proper heights. We mow at the proper times. If it's drought, if it's a dry weather, we're not necessarily out there with a mower trying to make sure that grass is, you know, same height. We can allow for some grass to not look green all the time. But in regards to fertilizer, we don't use any phosphorus in our park system. It's been mandated by us, and we agree that unless you are doing any type of seeding on soil, phosphorus is not necessary. Also, we do soil tests to determine, okay, is it necessary that we have to go out there and put fertilizer on it? But with the amount of acres that we mow, the amount of fertilizer we use is very, very, very minimal. But in regards to weed control or chemicals, you know, we especially in our playgrounds, we don't like to have weeds in our playgrounds, playground areas. So we do spray those periodically throughout the year to keep the weeds out. But if we're going to do any type of in regards to turf spraying or broadleaf spraying, we usually do one spraying in the fall. We try to spray as many parks as we can. That's the best time to do any spraying. But like I said, I don't want people to get excited that we go out there and spray all the time, because we don't.
And I think that's an interesting point of the fall spraying. I mean, I know in my neighborhood, there's all sorts of spraying going around, all sorts of, you know, different companies spraying, and there's the, you know, there's the cycle you should be spraying on and that sort of thing. But yet, really, if we just look at a focused, you know, spraying or fertilizing in the fall and seeding, that's really the best time. It's going to have the most benefit and make the most impact.
Exactly. You know, And granted, when especially in the spring, when people get excited that they start seeing green grass, they feel like they want to give it a big boost. And really, in regards to the health of the plant, you're really not doing anything. Mm-hmm. You're basically growing taller grass, and you're going to have to mow more. Mm-hmm. The best time to – exactly. You know, it's funny. And I get excited too because, I get green grass. I want to start growing. I got there and mow. But by the time you put fertilizer on the spring, it's like, okay, I got to mow a lot. But right. People get – people just need to be careful because in the springtime we get a lot of rains. And so proper timing is for that is the best. I'm not totally saying don't do it, but just be really careful. Because
we could maybe have some economic sustainability thrown
exactly,
in there.
Because the thing is, the grass plant coming out of the spring or coming out of dormancy has plenty of energy to mm-hmm. grow and grow well in the mm-hmm. spring. It doesn't necessarily need an extra boost.
Okay.
In the fall, in regards to fertilization, the competition is less. A lot of the summer annual weeds are starting to die off, and so you're not having as much competition. And so that's a great time to grow roots on the grass plant instead of trying to grow leaves. So
let nature take its course.
Exactly.
Right?
Uh-huh. Exactly.
I wanted to ask you about another aspect of the parks and the recreation that is not plant-based. Can you talk just for a few minutes about the restrooms and the water fountains and the shelters, that part of it? What goes into keeping those really
in a sustainable fashion?
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
In regards to the bathrooms, we have an individual that goes out there daily and cleans the restrooms and makes sure that they're in proper order for the patrons in the parks. In regards to sustainability, we're not using a ton of natural or environmentally free chemicals. Obviously, we're not going out there and dumping a bunch of chemical cleaning, but we're doing the best we can to make sure that we're cleaning them to the best of our ability. But we're not, as far as products, we're not – at this time, we're not really doing that. We're looking into it, or we have looked into it. But in regards to the water fountains, in the water system, we do our best to make sure that we provide clean water on a daily basis. And the city water plant does a great job. I mean, everybody knows how great our water is. But one thing that we want patrons to know is, if you see a leak in anything, if it's in a bathroom and a water fountain, please let us know, because we want to get that taken care of immediately. We try to use low flow fountains, so we're not wasting a bunch of water.
So how do people let you know?
So they can call our community center. Our phone number is 515-239-5350, and they will pass that word along. Or they can call our park shop, 239-5356, and that'll get us quickly to notification that there's an issue.
Of course. So. And you do, though, not use paper towels. So
correct.
You are
yeah.
looking at waste considerations and resource considerations
yeah.
in that standpoint. And lights are on, timing systems, and those sorts of
exactly.
things.
Exactly. One of the things that we've tried to incorporate when we've develop new structures or new shelters is add LED lighting
mm-hmm.
and then
mm-hmm.
also put them on a timer or
right.
some type of a photo cell so they're not on all the time. Our parks close at 10:30. If an individual, there are some shelters right now that we're working towards transitioning into shutting off at 10:30,
mm-hmm.
but also having a security light. So if the police department wants to drive by or there's a safety aspect there. We want to make sure that there is some lighting there. But, yeah, that's one thing we are transitioning to is all LED lighting in our shelters.
Mm-hmm.
We're not there yet by any means, but we've got a few shelters that are getting there.
Right.
So.
It'll make an incredible energy
yeah,
difference as
exactly.
well. Right.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, I'm looking at the clock and we're running out of time. We're talking with Mary Rankin, the Director of Sustainability for Iowa State University and Sustainability Coordinator for the City of Ames, and Joshua Thompson, Superintendent with Parks and Recreation. And we're talking about sustaining city parks. Any last words? Just give us one thing that we can look forward to before we close out.
Starting this Saturday, this is exciting. About 3 acres of land on the south side of Hayden will be managed by goats starting Saturday. And so that's exciting for us. It's a way for us to not have to take mechanical equipment to a piece of property to have it managed. So the goats are going to remove as many invasive species as possible as they can. And the whole goal of this is in restoration of an oak savanna, which is an oak savanna remnant on the south side of the park. So
it's wonderful.
Be looking for that
mm-hmm.
here coming
it's
this
fantastic.
Weekend.
Fantastic.
It's
yeah.
wonderful.
And bees.
Yeah.
Bees
yeah.
around our golf course
exactly.
areas
yes.
and pollinator plots and just all all wonderful things green and active and sustainable.
That's right.
Okay, thank you so much. Mary, you want to have the last word as we shut down the show?
Oh, well, it's always lovely to be here, and I am really excited to get out and experience all of our 36 parks. That's maybe going to be a goal of mine this summer. So thanks so much, Joshua.
Well, good luck, and thank you very much.
Yeah,
thank you. And this is Local Talk, and has been engineered by Evan Taylor, and we are just going to close out real quick because we're running out of time. So remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
This spring, KHOI asked you, our loyal listeners, to help us raise money toward our operations expenses. Thanks to your generosity and that of several premier donors who established a matching grant, we were able to exceed our fundraising goal. Because of your support, we are able to continue serving Central Iowa through the broadcast of community ideas and values for the foreseeable future. If you would still like to contribute to KHOI, give us a call at 515-292-2878 or visit us online at khoifm.org and click the donate button. Thank you again for making KHOI a reality in the heart of Iowa, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday.